Hello, listener of the Third Sector podcast. This is Lucinda, and I thought you might be wondering what this unusual piece of content is on the Third Sector feed. In addition to our weekly show, we've just launched The End of Charity. It's a six-part documentary in which we ask whether the current charity model is fit for purpose and explore what the future might hold for the sector. It features some of the leading voices from the charity world, as well as radical thinkers who believe there's a need to disrupt the status quo. If you'd like to hear more, you can search for The End of Charity and subscribe or follow to be the first to know when we release new episodes. I hope you enjoy it.
I would argue that everybody knows about mutual aid in some way, even if they don't know it by the term mutual aid. Mutual aid is a relatively new term for a concept that has been around ever since humans have existed, really. We have always supported each other. We have always worked together. We have always wanted to, as humans, have community, have care, have support. And that's what would fall under the term mutual aid.
You're listening to The End of Charity. I'm Lucinda Rouse. And in this episode, we explore some alternative forms of doing good. We'll hear from people for whom the traditional charity model isn't quite right, and we'll be finding out about the groups who are falling through the cracks of the system. Eshe Kiamazuri founded the UK Mutual Aid Network in 2018. Let's start with the basics. What exactly is mutual aid?
So that's difficult to kind of conceptualize into one small answer, because mutual aid in practice is a lot of things. It can be everything from checking in on your neighbors to running food drives to setting up reciprocal care projects in many, many different ways. In the past, we have seen a lot of Black radical mutual aid groups, which again may not have been called mutual aid groups at the time, but were effectively practicing mutual aid. We have OWAD, which was the Organization for Women of African and Asian Descent. We've had the Black Panther Party practice mutual aid. We had Race Today. And these are all projects which we're looking at how do we as a community ensure that every single one of us makes it through? And what do we need to do then if we have a small amount of privilege in comparison to somebody, whether that's time privilege, monetary privilege, access or resource privilege? How do we then utilize that so somebody who doesn't have that privilege is then able to access it?
Eshe touches on the roots of mutual aid in Black radical and anarchist campaigns. These date back to the 1700s, when recently freed African American communities pooled resources to provide their own social services in response to their exclusion from the mainstream system. But such community-minded movements are not all in the distant past. Remember this.
From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home. You should not be going shopping except for essentials like food and medicine. And you should do this as little as you can.
March 2020. Britain went into lockdown in response to the spread of COVID-19. And as everyday life ground to a halt, thousands of people started mobilising to support those around them who were most affected by the social and economic consequences of the pandemic. This is a genuine conversation from a WhatsApp group set up shortly after lockdown.
I'm going to Tesco's first thing tomorrow morning. Please let me know by 6 p.m. tonight if anyone would like anything.
You're a lifeline. If you could help with some soup, that would be lovely.
I'm collecting prescriptions today if anyone needs one collecting.
If anyone has donations they would like to give to the food bank this month, please leave them in the church porch before 11 a.m. on Wednesday.
Groups of people offering help and support to more vulnerable neighbours sprang up overnight, often operating on a hyper-local, street-by-street basis. But these weren't charities. They were mutual aid groups, self-organised groups of volunteers, and some of them deliberately distanced themselves from the formal voluntary sector. For Eshe, this desire to be set apart comes from their objection to what they believe charities fundamentally stand for and were born out of.
So, you know, for starters, there are many limitations with what charities can offer. But in general, again, the charity structure is, you know, it's a new structure in the same way that your concept, the theory of mutual aid, is relatively new, but it is practiced in something which is quite old. The charity structure is newer still. You know, it is born out of oppressive dynamic. It's born out of a saviorist dynamic. It's born out of white supremacy, this idea of a class dynamic, of enforcing a class dynamic too.
Hold on to that thought, because we're going to explore the parallels between charitable aid and colonial structures in a later episode. But back to mutual aid. Eshi has a problem with how the very term mutual aid was co-opted during the pandemic.
The term mutual aid did get very co-opted through the pandemic. It went from having quite radical revolutionary roots, from having, you know, communist anarchist roots, to becoming something which you were hearing police officers saying. You were hearing your local councillor was running a mutual aid group. You were hearing the charities were getting involved. And that cannot be mutual aid. The state cannot do mutual aid. The charities cannot do mutual aid. Mutual aid is within the community. But because the term had gotten so co-opted and used as a way for the state and the charity complex to no longer have to fulfill the roles that they should be fulfilling, because they could just slap mutual aid on it and make everybody do it for free instead, it started to impact the way that people were seeing our group. Because despite the fact we'd been using the term UK mutual aid for, you know, 2 years before the pandemic, it didn't matter anymore because other people were using the term mutual aid. There was a UK mutual aid list and people kept thinking we were that or that was us, you know. Once a term no longer fully, like, encompasses what you are actually trying to do, we have to stop and we have to assess, we have to do a kind of personal audit and think, okay, where can we change so that people are no longer going to make these assumptions? But also when people are joining us, they know what we're about from the beginning. We're not having to try to now redefine what mutual aid is and how mutual aid is now seen in the modern world.
UK Mutual Aid has now closed, but there are plans to relaunch as the Co-Care Project at some point in the future. In episode 2 of this series, we explored how the YouTube sensation Mr. Beast is making waves as a bold young philanthropist, rallying support and visibility for his chosen charitable causes among his millions of followers. In some ways, it's a far cry from the spirit of localized mutual aid movements, with community members looking out for each other. But there are definite similarities between this and Mr. Beast's drive to inspire young people to help those in need around them. So how do charities fit into this community-minded landscape? I took my microphone onto the streets of London to ask people with no formal involvement in the charity world for their views on what charities do.
Well, charities actually, they're voluntary. The whole thing is they render a whole lot of services to people who are more often than not disadvantaged or marginalised within the society that they live in.
Isn't the charities basically to help the people? The local authorities or the central government is not able to help them actually. So that's why the charities are established. I think the services, each community has got different needs. And some of the communities would require services for the children. And some will require for the elderly people. And some people will require for the people who are aging because they lived in this country for such a long time. If they can fulfill all these goals and objectives of each community, and then they're useful. If they don't, then then they're not.
These are two views on the role of charities. They talk about helping people in need in communities and society, offering services for those who are insufficiently provided for by the state or private sector. But one recurring criticism of charities, and particularly larger national ones, is that they can be out of touch with the very people they exist to serve.
When you actually look at the data of where charities deliver services, there's some clear kind of areas where they are clustered and where they aren't.
This is Theo Clay. what he's describing are sometimes called charity deserts. Until recently, Theo was the policy manager at the think tank New Philanthropy Capital. Before he moved on to a new role at Christian Aid, he worked on a piece of research into what people think about the state of the charity sector. And one of the problems is that there are fewer charities in areas where statistically the need for their services is greatest.
Charities reflect the conditions around them, basically. So what tends to happen is you see more charities clustered in wealthier areas and then fewer charities in areas of the country which might have lower incomes or other kind of poorer outcomes. This is basically because charities are obviously dependent on fundraising. A lot of people give locally, so it's definitely the case that charities who are based in those wealthy areas tend to receive more donations from people with a personal connection to those organisations. But also charities, you know, are really dependent on volunteers. Like, we know that most organisations in the country, most charities, don't actually have many paid members of staff. Areas where people are able to give more volunteering time might have more freedom or kind of less demands from paid work to give their time, then charities can benefit from that. In terms of what that means in practice, that means you see a lot of organisations per head in the southwest and southeast, much fewer in the northeast and northwest.
And those are the areas that are poorer.
Yes, exactly. The kind of quote-unquote left-behind areas which the Levelling Up agenda was meant to be trying to tackle. One thing that we found is that the gap between the wealthy and the poorer areas has actually been growing over the past few years. So that's charities in the wealthy areas are spending more money, and charities in the poorer areas are actually having their spend drop because of that kind of geographic split that obviously ends up having an effect on the types of people that those organisations are able to support as well.
That's a worrying finding. We're seeing a spike in charity closures caused by financial difficulties in the face of a general trend of growing need. And the inequality continues beyond geography and into demographic.
There's a lot of kind of subsectors of the charity sector which have fewer organisations and fewer large organisations. So you can think about the lack of income which goes to women's organisations, organisations focused on women in particular, which is really shocking. Similarly, the lack of kind of ethnic minority-led organisations, which we see as well, which is a real kind of absence in the charity sector.
A report by a group of UK funders found that less than 2% of grants in 2021 went to organisations that support women and girls. Another piece of research conducted by the Ubeli Initiative, an African diaspora-led organisation, found that in the early weeks of the pandemic, 9 out of 10 small and micro voluntary sector organisations led by Black and other minoritised people didn't have enough cash in the bank to keep going for longer than 3 months. And if you cast your mind back to my chat with Emma Reavy at the beginning of this series, the Trussell Trust has found that people from minority ethnic groups form a big chunk of food bank users. The data seems to point to a connection between this group also being underserved and underrepresented in the sector more generally. So is grassroots mobilisation, such as mutual aid, the answer to plugging gaps in social service provision and underfunded charitable areas? Eshi describes how requests for support to UK mutual aid skyrocketed during the pandemic, placing pressure on the group's organisers, which contributed to its ultimate closure.
We ended up having so many people come to us. Some of those were coming to us in ways which we were not comfortable with as well, which meant that we had to really look at what our group was providing and how people externally were seeing that. And so an example of that is we were receiving a lot of so-called referrals from Citizens Advice Bureau, from the DWP, Department of Work and Pensions. You know, we were receiving referrals where people were going to access state support, which they are eligible for, and they were being told, no, go to a Facebook group instead and ask for support from those people, which is highly inappropriate. And there was no confusion about this happening because sometimes people were coming to me by name and saying, you have been, like, I've been referred to you by name, by my name, Eshikia Missouri, as well as by UK Mutual Aid. And I've gone into an interview with, you know, DWP, and they've said, we don't want to give you any more benefits. go and ask for food money on a Facebook group. And we were just shook with how inappropriate that was, how wild it was. You know, we were not expecting those kinds of interactions. And of course, we helped everybody who came our way, but we are not a funded charity or organization. We are completely community funded, which means that we worked on like a person-to-person community funding dynamic, which meant that if you needed something, you posted in the group and the community fulfilled that wish. The money didn't come through UK Mutual Aid. The money didn't come from somewhere higher. It was person-to-person. And in that person-to-person dynamic, we actually raised £180,000 in person-to-person funding in the 2 years, 2020 to 2022, which, when you compare that to any charity, even, like, you know, we're still doing amazing. And that has all come from person-to-person funding. A little bit came from some donations from some other community groups, but that all then went back into person-to-person funding. It is highly inappropriate for the state, for the DWP, for CAB to see that and to think, okay, that means we don't have to do our jobs anymore. Those people over there will do it for us instead. That started to make us think, okay, is the way that we are being perceived an issue?
Eshi touches on something interesting here about resource. The state and the formal charity sector collectively has significantly more cash than your average grassroots movement. And Eshi believes that passing on some of the pie to community groups to spend as they please without conditions would solve a lot of problems.
Moving past this idea that financial support has to be so heavily guarded, has to be so heavily like on lock, is essential for charities, because really charity should be saying, we've got this amount in the pot, let's just give it to the people who need it. They should be doing that rather than saying, I need you to shuck and jive, like I need you to jump through hoops, I need you to put on a circus act to be able to get a little £500 to run a project for a week. In doing that, they're reinforcing what the state wants us to think about financial support, that it has to be earned or it can only be given if people are somehow seen as worthy of that support or somehow seen as able to manage that. Finances is just finances. We shouldn't be trying to oversee what people are doing with that if they're doing something within their communities. Charities can start by unlocking that box, and there are ways that they then can also continue to support within those roles as well. But they need to come in at the request of the community rather than demanding of the community.
Eshi has strong views on how grassroots community movements are meeting a need caused by charities and the state not pulling their weight. And Theo's helped us identify the social groups and parts of the country that are falling through the gaps. But what about people on the other end of the spectrum, individual donors who'd rather put their money to good use elsewhere? Back on the streets of London, and to the one person I found who strongly felt the world would be a better place without charities.
Don't do anything, really.
Why do you say that?
Because I just go around poncing. Charity begins at home, that's my attitude. Because there's enough of our own people who need us, like our own kids. You know, if you come to a crunch of giving charity a fiver or giving one of my kids a fiver, I will give my kids. They don't help that many people, because I mean, I know for a fact a lot of the times with charities they take so much money out of it that the charities don't get the full whack.
Giving your spare cash to a member of your own family is about as hyper local as it gets. Supporting grassroots community groups is one step up. But there are other choices for people who'd rather not donate to charity, but still want to contribute to good causes. Social enterprises and other ethically minded businesses pledge to solve some of the world's biggest problems as part of their business model. Take the upmarket outdoor clothing brand Patagonia. It's B Corp certified, meaning it's a business which demonstrates high social and environmental performance. And environmental sustainability is a core part of the brand's identity. Patagonia's founder, Yvonne Chouinard, is fighting fast fashion and its environmental consequences. In 2022, he transferred the company's stock to a trust and a not-for-profit organisation, declaring that, as of now, Earth is our only shareholder. Since 2023, 98% of Patagonia clothing has been made from recycled materials, while its cotton is organically grown, and it mainly uses fair trade certified factories. These adjustments mean added costs. Patagonia's products come at a premium because of the drive to make the supply chain more ethical. The company also pledges 1% of its sales revenue to preserving and restoring the natural environment by supporting grassroots organisations working to this end. So does this holistic approach to tackling the climate crisis mean buying a Patagonia coat is doing more good than a donation to the World Wildlife Fund might? And do donors, or consumers, even think along those lines?
We've worked with, I've incubated hundreds of social enterprises, and what we found is the consumer that's buying your product as their way of doing good is very, very small market. The reason they're buying your product is because they like the product, they like the brand, and they are socially conscious. And you know, maybe they're willing to pay a premium for it, or maybe they're just willing to pay a premium for the brand, right? Because the brand has brand cachet.
This is Tej Dharmi. She runs an advisory group called the Change Coefficient, which specializes in social enterprise and investment, or in other words, businesses that deliver social purpose as well as profit.
I don't think that that's the right distinction, that it's sort of, I'm going to put money into Patagonia to buy a coat from Patagonia, or I'm going to donate. One is I'm buying products or service. And I think that's the way we need to look at those consumers, because that is how they're making their decisions. You can segment the consumer base. There are those who will only ever buy the super socially conscious and environmentally conscious products, and they will happily pay a premium. They will happily go out of their way for those products, right? So they will go to markets and supermarkets where they can refill rather than having to buy new packaging. And they will go in that extra mile. That's a small segment of the market. The vast majority want to do the right thing, but not if it costs them in terms of money or, you know, additional work going out of their way. And if we really want to scale these organizations, that's actually the demographic that we need to hit.
Tej has spent much of her career looking into how the finance and business worlds can be adapted to help solve some of the world's most pressing problems. But as she learned early on, it's often easier said than done to deliver social impact and business profit at the same time.
I was very naive when I first learned about social enterprise, because, you know, the old adage was you can do well and do good at the same time. And one of my key learnings, having done this now for almost 15 years, is how challenging that really is. That, you know, there are some places where that works really well, but the social enterprise or the business model isn't always effective across all the kind of social good that you would want to create.
Towards the beginning of her social investment journey, Tej took part in an incubator program for budding social entrepreneurs. The cohort was supported to develop business ventures that promised to provide solutions to specific social problems.
One of my peers was an organisation called PlayAble that were doing incredible work, working with sports coaches in countries where there were as a large portion of children that were disabled, largely because they were, you know, countries that had been through war. And he was training these coaches to make innovations in the game to include those children with disabilities. And the transformation for those children was huge. You know, the case studies and the stories that he could tell you were incredible, about children feeling like they had no value, suddenly becoming the star player on a soccer team and realizing their disability didn't have to hold them back from living a full life. And it was just the most beautiful model, had an incredible impact. But the reality is there is no way to monetize that. Their families couldn't pay for this. The coaches wouldn't necessarily pay for this, because there was a lot of cultural behavior change work that needed to go on to kind of convince them this was something that could be done. Those kinds of models where there's deep work and behavior change, quite often they're really, really difficult to turn into a sustainable model. A lot of things just need grant funding.
Grant funding, or money that doesn't have to be paid back, is not an idea that sits comfortably in the world of business, where the number one priority is profitability and a return on investment. It's not unusual for business startups to flop. Unfortunately, Tej's colleague in the incubator program was one of them. But Tej believes there are certain types of problems which can never be solved through a commercial model. Does this mean charity still has its place?
Yeah, I think one of the problems we have in the sector with social investment and social enterprise is this somewhat arbitrary distinction between charity and social enterprise. Everyone working in that field is aiming to do good. And the question we always pose is, what is the most efficient way we can deliver that impact? Because also that's where you get the most return on investment. It's not, you know, necessarily if you have impact this year, but if you can make an investment this year that has impact for kind of the next 10 years and you're amortizing that investment, that is really when you're maximizing social return on investment. So I think as a sector, we need to be a lot less rigid about this is a commercial model and this is a charity model and start blending a lot more. And that's what we talk about in our recent report on catalytic capital, which is social investment that is flexible, patient, concessionary, or risk tolerant, or some combination thereof. And what we're saying is it's not either grants or fully repayable investment. There is a spectrum, and that supports a spectrum of organizations operating in different ways. So we work with social enterprises that have, you know, that take grants, and that's how they reach their hardest to reach consumers. And that works because they know their customers, they can deliver that really well. I think we need to be a lot less rigid about, you know, you work in this space and we work in that space, and also just get more comfortable with these blended approaches, because that really is how we maximize impact. Having said that, blended approaches are not easy. What we're talking about is efficiently using resources. And what people rightly get uncomfortable with is subsidizing a commercial model. If a model is commercial, it should stand on its own two feet. If it's not, then it needs subsidy. And while it's very easy for me to sit here and talk about we need to take that blended approach, in reality, defining that line of where you need some subsidy and where that's the best way to make impact and where something is commercial and should stand alone is quite tricky. And it's something that we need to have more conversations about, to be honest.
Speaking of conversations, I was very keen to have one with Patagonia to get to the bottom of the company's aversion to partnering with charities in its environmental protection work. It's long been part of Patagonia's ethos to support grassroots environmental activists ever since it was founded in 1973. So why the preference for smaller groups working to save and restore habitats at a very local level? Wouldn't a blended approach involving established charities be a good option to help heal the planet? Unfortunately, we don't have an answer straight from the horse's mouth, as Patagonia declined my invitation to appear in this series. But we do know that its founder, Yvonne Chouinard, believes local battles build public support to confront big issues. We also know that he values the importance of bringing marginalised communities to the forefront of the environmental movement. And being a privately held company, Patagonia has the freedom to fund risk-taking groups in a way that more bureaucratic charity structures might struggle to justify to their donors and their governing boards. But as Tej points out, there are areas where social enterprises do very well in solving problems in a way that is also commercially advantageous. These include tech solutions and renewable energy.
So if you think about renewable energy, you increase your profits when you have more renewable energy. You increase your impact when you have more renewable energy, right? There is absolutely no conflict there. They're totally hand in hand. You know, you're providing energy, it's price competitive now, but it hasn't got those negative externalities.
I asked Tej for her views on the Patagonia model and the company's pledge to put the planet first.
I'm a cynic at heart. I don't know enough about Patagonia. I know that there is debate around the sustainability of some of their products. And that to me highlights this conflict that you know, I think there's often very, very good intent, but it's very, very tricky to sort of manage a sustainable business and create that impact in the environment that we're in, right? Because, you know, you're either sustainable and commercial and you can access the funding you need to grow, or you're not. And then you're sort of, you know, you can access this small pool of grants. And that's where I think a lot of organisations get stuck in the middle. And maybe they would make different choices from an impact perspective if they could access different kinds of funding. So I can't speak to their model, but I'm very familiar with the challenges that that brings. John Lewis is a great example. You know, there's a huge amount of noise and kind of interest in employee ownership at the moment. And employee ownership has many, many great aspects to it. But if you look at John Lewis, they're struggling now. And they're thinking about moving away from that so they can access the funding they need to sustain themselves and grow, right? So our funding environment is limiting these organizations from having the impact and being and having the culture that they want to create. And I think that's very sad.
So as with Eshi's objection to funders forcing community groups to shuck and jive in order to receive a small grant, socially conscious businesses are being constrained from developing sustainable solutions to problems by the attitudes of those holding the cash. But this idea of a blend of options as a force for good sounds appealing. And speaking of a force for good,
the oceans are rising, never compromising, the oceans are rising.
Can charities be effective pressure groups?
They have been increasingly defanged and unable to criticise the state without jeopardising their own either funding contracts or kind of position as a charity.
Or does their complex relationship with government mean they need to stand aside for bolder, more agile movements? In the next episode, we'll be looking at the role of charities as campaigners for change. The End of Charity is brought to you by Third Sector, the UK's leading title for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector. It was written and presented by me, Lucinda Rouse, and edited by Emily Burt. The producers were Ollie Piatt and Penny Bell at Rethink Audio. And special thanks to Rebecca Cooney, who devised the original concept for the series.